Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
This is Tim Reedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone in this Christmas week. I'm joined, of course, by Carrie Weber and our colleague, Father Eric Sundra.
We have on the show today Liam Callanan. And he is the Hunt Prize Award winner for that, which is a prize that we distribute,
yes.
In fact, for arts and letters. And it is a kind of award that really celebrates the word and celebrates exactly what we're talking about here. Although he's not translating anything. Although his work has been translated into other languages, so he may have some thoughts on that. But so he won the award in 2017. He's the author of a number of novels, including The Cloud Atlas, which he mentions in his essay for us recently, and the forthcoming book, Paris by the Book. And his work, as I mentioned, has or will be translated into Chinese, German, Italian, and Japanese. And he is in the English department of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and was previously the chair there of that department. And he coordinated the PhD program in creative writing. So a lot on his plate. Liam Callanan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
We're very glad to have you. Now, you have recently written an essay for us about truth and fiction. It says, good fiction may teach us what to believe, but fiction teaches us how. You can find it at americamagazine.org. And you start out with a really interesting anecdote about your first novel and the process of creating that, and then some sort of surprising follow-ups to the publication of it. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. My first novel was called The Cloud Atlas, not to be confused with David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, although actually it's happily confused by many readers for one for the other. But I think we sell a ton of books by mistake, or he does. I'm not sure.
One of you has some padded numbers.
Exactly. And one of us has the different star ratings, too. I love all the people who, like, review my book and say, like, this is nothing like the Tom Hanks movie. It is indeed nothing like the Tom Hanks movie. And in a case of another conflated identity, what was interesting to me and the anecdote that my essay opens with is that the protagonist of my novel is a missionary priest to Alaska whose name is Louis Belk. B-E-L-K, and it was a completely made-up name. In fact, the original name that I had for that character was Bell, and I thought, well, Bell's a great, you know, kind of musical name, but then as the novel went on and my character got kind of more and more tortured and more baggage came with him, I thought, I need kind of a harsher consonant at the end, and so I came up with K, and it became Belk. The name Lewis actually comes from Father Lewis, my Thomas Merton, my great uncle or cousin, I've never been quite sure of the relation, was a Trappist at Gethsemane with him. So Lewis came to me that way, but then Belk I just wholly invented on my own. And Belk is, in this novel, is in charge of a very strange part of World War II where the Japanese were sending bombs to North America tied to paper balloons. And so my protagonist is tasked in his youth, before he became a priest, with finding these balloons. And what happened was, after the book came out, a guy wrote me in my inbox and said, why did you write a book about me? Which does not usually happen when you're writing fiction. And he pointed out that his name was Louis Belk. And he'd also been in bomb disposal in World War II in the Army Air Corps, like my guy. He hadn't been to Alaska, but nevertheless, I thought, here's a case where truth and fiction really do kind of meld with each other very well. And so in a kind of very surprising way. And it kind of just reminded me that the boundaries between these notions are a little bit more permeable. And that sometimes we can believe in something to the extent that we can, in a way that like the mysteries of grace are sometimes impossible for us to kind of understand, like why Louis Belk was called to my imagination, and then why he would kind of be summoned up from real life. I wasn't really sure, but what I came away from that was, and what I wrote him was, like, I'm writing fiction, so this is a really made-up story, because he was a little bit offended that I didn't want to write a sequel that focused on his life in great detail. And I thought, no, that's not the job of a novelist. The job of a novelist is to create. And I also realized why we have those little standard disclaimers in the front about any relation to persons living or dead are really coincidental, because they are. So I'm still waiting for someone to write the book about with the protagonist Liam Callinan in it, but luckily that has not happened yet.
We could start working on that.
Exactly.
Now, maybe you can speak to, I mean, Liam, your own personal story, where you at one point, as you write about in your essay, decided you were in a, kind of in communications, and so doing a different kind of writing, and decided to, you know, kind of focus entirely on fiction, and that was a big kind of major moment in your life. Could you speak a bit about that decision, and like, what's the, why did you feel such a calling to go down this road?
That's a really interesting question, and in the essay, as I describe, it's almost like they should have spoiler alerts for radio, but
right.
Also it's just kind of it's a powerful part of the essay and for my own kind of life story and story of witness. So it's, I'm trying to figure out how to tell it on the radio, but we're among friends on the Catholic Channel.
Yes.
I'll just trust you and the listeners to do this. So I was when I first got out of college, I went to live in D.C. With some family down there because it was free. And I'll never forget that my uncle, who's been a carpenter for about 45, maybe going on 50 years now, asked me one day exactly what I was going to do. And I said, I was going to be a writer. And he said, but you're going to get a job, right? And it hadn't struck me, because I was such a young, callow youth at that point, that I actually did need to get a job, because I was living rent-free with my sainted grandmother, who, in addition to her saintly ways, promptly looked in the church bulletin and noticed that Catholic Charities, the national office, was hiring someone to be a filing assistant. And so I went down and I got that job, and I worked there for several years. And then one thing led to another in their communications department, and then I eventually left to go do a job copywriting and doing corporate communications elsewhere. And suddenly I just found myself on this path. I was a writer, but I wasn't necessarily writing the kind of stuff that I thought I was going to be writing, which was novels and fiction and magazine articles. And instead, I was just kind of going along in this other life. And I wasn't exactly sure how I was going to make the transition out of it, especially because we were expecting our first child at the time. And so it just didn't seem very responsible. My wife was employed, but it just didn't seem very responsible to kind of quit and write the great American novel with someone on the way. And so what happened was, actually, that child did, in fact, arrive, but she died shortly before she was born. And her name was Lucy. And in the wake of her arrival and passing, my wife and I just thought we just really needed to reevaluate kind of where things stood, and if what are we on this earth for if not to kind of live out the lives that we're called to. And so with my loving and ever patient wife's full support, I did quit my job, not necessarily to write the great American novel, but just to kind of find my way forward. And one thing led to another, and eventually it led to graduate school, and graduate school led to that first novel, and then very, very fortunately to three more daughters following the arrival of our first, who are now all healthy and happy and in the midst of midterms and finals at their various schools as we speak. But it was a journey that just reminded me that, and reminds me honestly every day, because I named her, we named her Lucy before I even knew. I looked up later that Lucy's the patron saint of writers. And I thought, oh, that's just too powerful a coincidence to be a coincidence.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of really made me realize that sometimes following the path is not as easy as it originally seems to be.
Well, thank you for sharing. But that's a very powerful part of your essay, and we appreciate you sharing that with us. But we should say also, you write in your essay that I guess following the advice of your uncle, who said that you're going to get a job. As you write, writing is a job. It is hard work. Maybe you can speak about that.
It is hard work. And I think, you know, I thought at first that that, you know, writing was just, I think I had the romantic vision that everyone did. You know, you sat down at a cafe with a little cup of coffee, and you can't smoke now, but still, and you kind of stare thoughtfully out the window. And then a couple days later, a novel emerges. And the first thing I learned was, like, one, I wasn't really cut out to write on my own. I needed some what I call corporate detox to kind of get me out of the corporate world and into the writing world. And that was, for me, a graduate program, an MFA program. And even there, that was a long apprenticeship. And I remember when I graduated, my thesis advisor, the ever-wise Susan Richard Shreve, another novelist, kind of patted the stack of papers I'd given to her. And she said, "This is wonderful. Now, if you want to write a novel..." And so I was like, "Oh dear." And so I had to kind of start over the revision there. So it's just, I'm reminded every day of just how difficult it is. And honestly, in preparation for this interview, the first thing I did this morning was to make sure I got my 500 words in, because I knew otherwise I'd feel too badly about myself during the call. But it's something I teach students every semester about writing, and they all kind of look up, and particularly the younger students look up at me with these eyes and just say, like, "But this was supposed to be easy." And I was like, "Oh my goodness, this was supposed to be easy." You know, it's not that it can't be fun at times, because I also don't subscribe that like writing must be torture. But it doesn't necessarily, I think if it was, it's like, I always joke, you know, people come up to me after readings and they'll say like, "Oh, I've got a great idea for a novel, but I've never had time to write it." And I was like, no one goes up to a neurologist and says, "I've got a great idea for brain surgery, but I just have never had time to do it." You know, I think we have this notion that writing is something that just kind of comes and occurs, and other fields kind of take practice. And I feel like writers sometimes feel that way. We get frustrated with ourselves that the words aren't coming as fast. And I think they kind of come out differently for everyone at a different rate with different adventures before you.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes it feels like it should be easy, and that can kind of stop you from the process, because it just makes you feel like, wait, maybe everyone else is having a much easier time at this than I am, and I should not do this.
Exactly. I mean, I love the metaphor of like writing is like pottery, although I know nothing actually about pottery. So,
but you know a lot about metaphors, I imagine.
I love that metaphor, but I do know a lot about metaphors. So, but pottery, like, I think the first thing you do is put all the clay on the wheel, and then you get things spinning and you get dirty, and then you eventually just take away everything that isn't a pot, if that's what you're making. And I think that writing is so much the same way, particularly novels. You got to put everything out there in the beginning, and then just slowly kind of take away everything that's not a pot. Or in this case, I mean, working this last essay for America, it was just a wonderful process, because it really kind of caused me to kind of really kind of look at kind of who I was and how I developed as a writer. And then the really magical thing for me was, so the Hunt Prize ceremony was in September, and then the essay appeared online about a month ago, and then more recently in the pages of the magazine. And there was another edit with the with you guys after that, and I have to say it really improved, thanks to the, you know, editorial suggestions and feedback I got. I mean, I'm talking to editors and writers on the show right now. I'm sure you've all experienced
that. Yeah, the editing process, I mean, as editors, we like to think that matters too.
We like to think we're doing good.
Well, absolutely. You know? I mean, I think it's a little bit like medicine. First, do no harm. But
exactly.
I've had some good edits and less ones, but my America edit was... definitely one of the best I
read. Good. Well, we'll give Jim Keen credit.
We'll have to put that on our Yelp review of our editor.
Yes, 3 stars.
I also want to mention that we did a video. We visited with Liam and his family outside. Are you in Milwaukee? Is that where you are, Liam?
Milwaukee, center of the universe.
Center of the universe, of course. So we have a nice video, kind of. So you mentioned your daughters. You get a little taste of your life. Maybe you can speak a bit about, like, as a writer, you kind of referred to it before, it can be kind of an isolating experience. How have you found a community? Is it in part, like, obviously your family, but also your writing community, the folks you teach at Marquette?
Actually, I'm up the street from Marquette at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, right. Oh, sorry. Yeah, well.
It's the Jesuit influence coming through here.
I know. Boy, there's Jesuits. It's just all the kind of.
I'm just planting the seed. That's all.
Exactly. If you're listening, Mike Lovell, I'm sure. That's the truth. But that's actually just brings up a great opportunity of community, which is two of my best writing friends are down there, C.J. Reibel and Larry Watson, and I think one of the pleasures of being in Milwaukee is that the community is a little bit more tight-knit than, say, that, you know, those mysterious cities in the East like New York. I think I'm relatively rare as a writer in that I really enjoy the moments of community. I don't necessarily write well. Like, I don't go to writing parties. I know some people do, where everybody kind of flips open their laptop and like a novel gets pounded out. I would be terrified.
I didn't know that's a thing.
That's a thing. I did not know
oh,
that.
Yeah.
You know, apparently it's really a thing.
It's supposed to be, I think, you know, the idea that if someone's clacking away on their keyboard, that will encourage you to clack away on yours. But I think there's like nothing could be worse, actually. So, I write by myself, but I really enjoy kind of talking with other writers and kind of especially with student writers, because I feel like we're all in this together. It's much less of a, like, a, you know, I will teach you how to do this than like, let's all roll up our sleeves and work on how to figure this out together. But the community of writers is really important to me, and that's honestly one of the pleasures of publishing, is that you get called into different communities by, you know, people who read your stuff. And, you know, ever since that essay came out in America, I suddenly have like a whole new subset on my Twitter feed of people, and kind of the ideas that we can exchange and go back and forth. And so that's a really kind of pleasurable part of it. When I very, very first started writing, I was that person in the cafe with the laptop open, and it was a great way to kind of get work done, because it was a Panera that I wrote at, and I was terrified that someone would steal my laptop, and so I would never get out of my chair. And that turns out to be like the most important writing advice I ever had. So, and it was helpful then, because I was living in Washington, D.C. Milwaukee is such a kind city that it's very easy to get out of your chair. But I feel like, you know, it's those communities that we make for ourselves, communities of readers, communities of writers, that didn't really make it worth doing.
Yeah. Now, when you write in your essay about when you were young and you reached out to a particular writer that you admired, and you wanted to know a little bit more about what his novel meant, in some ways maybe the start of your trying to build that community of writers. Can you talk a little bit about that interaction and how that sort of influenced the way you approached your writing?
Absolutely. I mean, that was so, the writer mentioned here is probably familiar to listeners, and if not, should be. You should actually kind of drop your radio immediately and go run to the library or bookstore and grab some of William Kennedy's work from Albany, the Milwaukee of the East. he is an amazing, amazing author, and my amazing 12th grade English teacher at Loyola High School in Los Angeles, Sylvia Rousseff, introduced me and all of us in AP English that year to his novel Ironweed, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book, and completely foreign to, you know, a boy like I was in Los Angeles. I mean, this is set in early 20th century Albany, a guy down on his luck, and it kind of follows the homeless and down and out of Albany at that time. And it's a journey of redemption, or that's what I was wondering if it was. And because I was 17 and didn't know any better, I had some questions about the ending of the book. And I, well, nowadays you'd email him, but I actually wrote out a letter and not only invited him to kind of tell me what the ending really meant, because it's ambiguous, like all great endings, but to actually come and visit our class and tell us in person. And instead of him ignoring me or brushing off or writing an angry letter back, he politely declined the invitation to show up on our doorstep. but he did kind of say, like, well, really, the answer is up to you. He did endorse the idea of a journey of redemption, but exactly how it had ended, he said that was for the reader to work out. And that was a powerful experience for me. One, it was kind of a notion of, like, how to write, which is to kind of leave additional readings or openings possible into the interpretation of text, leave that to your readers. But then also this notion that readers are involved in that process. And it's something that can sometimes be frustrating for writers, because sometimes the readers will take things in a completely different way. I remember someone writing a review of the Cloud Atlas, which again is set in World War II Alaska, who said, well, clearly this book is based on the third chapter of Genesis, which I confess it is not. But nevertheless, that was the reading that he was bringing to the text. And so he was completing the text that way. And so I have found, and I find that I do it myself. I mean, you know, we all bring different things to a text and they speak to us in different ways. And so I find readers really complete a text that way.
Liam, I was in the essay that you did for us. You've got this line that just it stuck out every time I read it. I was at the ceremony as well, so I remember you giving the presentation, and I just remember just being amazed and listening to the stories that you were telling. You said, "Fiction teaches us empathy," and I'm wondering how do you think that comes about? Why fiction does that so well, and what are the contours of that statement?
That is a great question. And I'm now stroking my chin, although you can't see it on the radio, hoping I can bring a great answer to it. I think that that's the essential muscle that fiction teaches, because fiction, of course, asks you to generate a world. The author gives you the raw materials of doing that. The author says, this book is set in Alaska, or this book is set in Paris, and you bring to it whatever knowledge you have of those places, even if it's very scant. But nevertheless, even though the author's done a lot of imagination for you, what's really being demanded of you is, like, what is happening here? And that's different from nonfiction. Nonfiction, even though someone's trying to create a world, that world actually exists. And so that's much more a question of sympathy. But empathy, where you actually have to put yourself into this other fictional character's place, I think that's what fiction's all about. And I think that's why some types of fiction are more difficult or exhausting for readers than others, if they require us to do more work, if we encounter characters whom we haven't read before or scenarios that we hadn't considered. That requires more work of the reader, and that can be a little bit tiring, but I think it's absolutely essential. And so that notion of, like, getting to know a character, really kind of allowing yourself to kind of imagine who they are, that seems like a really important life skill, honestly, because we meet people all the time that we don't know. I mean, even, you know, I think it's interesting, people who are listening to this radio broadcast are having to kind of picture in their heads just how handsome and attractive and well-spoken we all are. I mean, at least for the New York studio, I know that's the case. But that's the same way for a reader of a text. I mean, I think it's amazing that in the 21st century, we can still have this medium of words on a page, just kind of various marks and squiggles and black and white, and that can still conjure a world for us. And I think that certainly the world would be a better place if we all knew how to practice more.
Right.
Empathy. And I think fiction's a great way to do it.
Yeah, we just have a few minutes left, but I'm struck by the idea that it also involves a certain level of vulnerability, right? We have to care about people that have been sort of created by somebody else, and be willing to be taken where you want us to go with them, rather than, you know, what our own hopes or desires for those characters and those lives might be. And that's a great lesson for life in general.
It is. I think, you know, I mean, I go back again to Loyola High School, and our watchword then, as now for, I think, all Jesuit institutions, is the words of Father Arupe, to be a man for others. And I think that I don't want to diminish that by saying that's a great tool for fiction writers, but I think it's a good way to live, but it's also an interesting way to kind of think about being a text, like to kind of give yourself over, to kind of be vulnerable to that, and to realize that you're not in charge, or, you know, that being helpful to someone else can sometimes mean transporting yourself into their shoes. And if there's a good author who allows you to do that, like I said, no experience could have been farther from me than 1930s Albany in William Kennedy's novel Ironweed. But with the help of his writing, which is rich and magical, but also extremely spare, so it had a lot of gaps that you were able to fill in, I was there, and I was able to appreciate what it was like for someone living with as much guilt as his protagonist lived with, living with as thin means as his protagonist lived with, and really taught me kind of what that was like, and then also kind of forced me to imagine, like, what would I do in that sort of same situation.
Right. So. We have about 2 minutes left. I wonder if in that brief time you could give us one book or one author we should all be reading right now. Who's writing right now? Somebody topical, besides yourself, obviously.
and besides the people on this call.
Yeah, sure.
I'm a big fan of all these folks. Well, you know, another author that I mention in the piece is Kirsten Valdez Quaid, who I think is really an incredible author. She teaches at Princeton right now. She's got a book of stories called Night at the Fiestas. She writes a lot out of her kind of growing up area. New Mexico is kind of the home base for her stuff. It's often unsettling, but in like wonderful, wonderful ways. And I think she just has a lot of interesting things to say about people and the places that they inhabit, both in terms of faith and then also kind of in terms of people who have kind of lost that notion of what grace is all about. But I think she's really a remarkable, remarkable writer. And so I put her at the top of the list. But
very good. Well, thank you. Thank you. Absolutely. And we have a profile of her coming up in our magazine,
yes.
It turns out.
Yes. No, I was hoping you were going to say her name. We have a piece coming out.
It was not pre-planned.
No, it was not pre-planned. Yeah, kind of came together. It's going to be in our special Women in the Church issue, profile by Jenny Shank, another author. So that'll be out in just a few weeks.
Yeah, so look forward to that. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Liam Callinan, for being on the show. Thank you for your work on behalf of Fiction and Truth. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Merry Christmas. Thanks,
Merry
Liam.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
So you can look up more of, you can look up Liam's essay on our website, americamagazine.org. You can also check there for this profile of Kirsten Valdez Quaid, who will be...
It'll be a few weeks, but it'll be up
weeks,
soon.
But, so keep checking every day. Come back.
Check every day. See if it's still there.
And go through and...
And the video. Don't forget the video.
And check out the video of Liam as well. So feel free to join us at americamagazine.org. If you want to subscribe, you can call 1-800-627-9533 to join the conversation. We appreciate your listening. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.